From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Jay Burke. The Mental Immunity Project is an ambitious effort to help everyone develop their own immunity to sneakily manipulative information. The job that we all have to discern real factual information from that sneakily manipulative information is a big one. And obviously one that most of the world hasn't yet mastered. Enter our next guest, cognitive scientist Andy Norman, who founded the Mental Immunity Project and proposes a new approach to our world's misinformation problem. It's one centered on the idea that minds have immune systems of their own. It's a suite of evolved mechanisms for spotting and shedding problematic information. Andy Norman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do tell about this natural inclination that our brains have, because I thought that has been all but evolved out of us from the way people seem to be behaving about believing misinformation.
Yeah, there's a lot of, shall we say, misbelieving, believing in things that aren't true. And that when you look at that, it's easy to think that we have no mental defenses at all. But the fact is, our minds have been evolving alongside infectious information for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And we've all developed a capacity to spot and shed such information, which isn't to say it always works well or even close to as well as it needs to these days. But understanding how those mental defenses work can help us strengthen them so that they perform even better.
So you say that every culture and subculture has this infrastructure, maybe not even in our own minds, but you know, out there in the world for slowing the spread of bad ideas. These are things like fact-checking and investigative journalism. But how many people actually fact check? And if you do fact check, you know, are the sources that you're going to fact check, how do you know if they are real or correct?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think just in the last couple of decades, we've transitioned from a world where information is essentially scarce and precious to one where it's just super abundant and cheap. And in fact, it's so cheap now that bad actors can produce massive amounts of misleading and false information and thereby hijack our attention and our minds. So we live in a very different world now. And the strategies we've both evolved and developed culturally to navigate the, shall we say, information environment, they're not up to the task of beating back the assaults on our minds that both bad actors and unwitting actors who pass along problematic information without knowing any better. So it's a very different world now, and I think we need a radically new approach to thinking about information so that we can cope and adapt more easily.
So you talk a lot about bad ideas. I mean, we all know what a bad idea is, but like how do you define a bad idea specifically in your line of work?
That's a really central question. So the thing to notice here is that, you know, although scholars have been looking at mis and disinformation very closely in recent years, philosophers have been studying more or less the same problem by trying to figure out how to spot bad ideas and shed those for thousands of years. So the philosophers have worked this problem for a long, long time. I think everybody carries within them their own definition of good and bad, and we apply those to the information we come across. The real challenge here is trying to come up with shared standards, because to live together, we need shared standards. Now, when you talk frankly about bad ideas, a lot of people get nervous very fast because they think, well, who's to say which ideas are good and which are bad. Are, if you talk that way, mightn't we empower a thought police to tell us what we have to think and what we have to believe? It's important not to overreact to the suggestion that we have shared standards and assume that it will immediately become Orwellian, because there are lots of non-Orwellian ways to regulate the information. Just think about critical thinking. My guess is that all three of us are fans of critical thinking. That's a way to regulate information, but it's not an Orwellian way to regulate information. So we need to get over this kind of allergy to frank talk about bad ideas and frank talk about information regulation, because we actually do have to solve that problem if we're going to survive this crazy new digital age.
You said it's negligence, you know, not to judge or question. I mean, talk about this, and how do you come to that position of a good idea versus a bad idea?
Yeah, and I must confess, I don't think I fully answered your first question, so I'm glad you brought me back to that. I wasn't trying to evade it. So the question, how do you define good ideas and bad ideas, makes a lot of people nervous because they're not sure how to define it. And the problem, and philosophers have struggled with this every time they've tried to invite people to explore deep questions. Deep questions can be really unsettling and make us wonder whether our value systems are fundamentally well-structured. That's an anxiety-causing kind of question to ask. And one of the first things you have to do when you teach philosophy is help kids, in this case, my case, college students, let go of their fear of uncertainty and explore these questions about, you know, what is justice? What do we mean by truth? What do we mean by good idea? What do we mean by bad idea? We need to actually be able to explore those questions in open and honest dialogue and hear how other people define the term and try to take account of the wisdom they bring to the table. What we can't do is simply punt on the whole question because it makes us uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I would argue that there are ideas have lots of properties. Some of them are good making and others are bad making. So truth is a good making quality in an idea. Falsehood is a bad making quality. If an idea has a tendency to incite violence, that's also a bad thing. If it has a tendency to bring people together and promote human flourishing, that's a good thing. So we actually need to look at all of the different properties of ideas and frankly estimate to the best of our ability how much they, to what extent they're true and to what extent they help us or harm us. And I'm not claiming, as somebody who talks frankly about these, that I have all the answers, but I am inviting everyone to join the conversation so that we can start treating this problem like grownups instead of just running away from it the way free speech absolutists would have us do.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with cognitive scientist Andy Norman. He's the author of the book, Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. He's also the founder of the Mental Immunity Project. Okay, Andy, we've got to get to an example here. So I had seen an article in Wired Magazine. And first of all, you say, okay, Wired Magazine, we have to question how do we question the validity and the truth and the facts included in an article in Wired Magazine, for example. And then this was an article about how there's a little Russian infiltration into our media sources, or rather social media, attempting to divide us by exacerbating the issues that are going on at the border. So can you take that and tell us how we can critically think and how that little device in our brain that actually can help us with immunity, how it may or may not function?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful example. So it turns out when I mentioned bad actors using information to divide us and harm us, I think it's called the Russian Internet Agency. The Russian Information, I forget the name of the agency, but it's been successfully dividing democratic societies for many, many years, in part because free speech absolutists won't let us take reasonable measures to reduce what national security people call influence operations. So we know, for example, that the Russian Internet Agency used inflammatory stories, most many of them false narratives, to exacerbate partisan tensions in the run-up to the 2016 and the 2020 elections. So a lot of the Black Lives Matter and counter Black Lives Matter protests were actually incited by Russian provocateurs in order to make Americans feel divided against themselves. This strategy has been working really well in democracies over much of the world. Interestingly, and here's the good news, some former Soviet bloc countries like Lithuania, Estonia, and now Finland have gotten really good at combating this disinformation. They've developed a powerful new approach to educating their populace, their citizenry, so that they don't fall for this. And all the evidence suggests that they're nailing it. They're really doing it right. And so we need to start educating our young people and helping one another the way the Finns and the Lithuanians do, because they've actually developed a high level of immunity to Russian disinformation, and it's helping them flourish in ways that we're not, that we don't.
Now, there was an operative word there, educate our young people. But Andy, it also seems to me that perhaps the most vulnerable are the older people who aren't wise to the ways of the internet and, you know, some of the, you know, they grew up in the days of Walter Cronkite, where you, that was the one news source and you believed it. And now there are all these other many, many, many news sources and newsletters and subscriptions to things that are so misleading and lacking in fact.
You're absolutely right, Lynn. I mention young people because in some ways they're the easiest to, that's the low-hanging fruit. If we can help young people become less vulnerable to manipulative information, we can lay a groundwork for a better future. But trying to help people who grew up in a very different information environment, helping them adjust, that's a lot harder. And you're right, older people often struggle with to identify and shed disinformation much more than young people do. It's harder to teach old dogs new tricks. I'm not going to give up on us old guys entirely, but it's a challenge.
You talk about mind vaccine, which, you know, clearly is non-biological, but
no needles involved, as I like to
right,
say.
Right. But learned tactic. I mean, what can be done with this to move in a positive direction, you know, and question more is, I presume that's part of the yeah, mind vaccine, if you will.
Yeah, I actually think that doubts are the antibodies of the mind, and that when you learn to listen to your doubts and express them with good questions, your mind's immune system gets stronger. So I think that education in our new digital age should focus on the mastery of questioning skills. So it no longer makes sense to have kids sit still for the first 20 years of their lives and to pack as much many facts as we can into their skulls. That's just a silly and wasteful use of their time and attention. And frankly, it bores them silly. All of those facts are easily accessible online anyway now. We don't need to use our heads as knowledge receptacles. Far better, we should be teaching people how to think, not what to think. We should be teaching people how to ask questions and to challenge one another in gently affirming ways so that they can seek the truth together rather than dissolve into partisan bickering. This can be done. We know how to do this. And it turns out that by looking at the way biological vaccines work, you get lots of good ideas about ways to help our minds do this similar work better. In fact, if you look at the way immunologists talk about how vaccines work, they actually say the vaccines teach the body how to manufacture antibodies. They use the language of teaching and learning to talk about how the immune system adapts.
Well, you're a part of a collab. So is this an organization? It's a group of people, I presume, that you're working in this direction to maybe open up these channels of teaching and educating on how to think more clearly for yourselves?
Yeah, we bring together both basic researchers who are studying how mis and disinformation spread across the internet, and some really wonderful research on how to develop resistance to problematic information. In fact, one of my colleagues, Sander van der Linden, is a psychologist at Cambridge University, and he was on 60 Minutes, and he was talking with Leslie Stahl about how, so it turns out that, you know how a vaccine often gives you an exposure, actually exposes you to the very thing that you want to teach the body to fight off? Well, we can do the same thing with our minds. So if you expose kids to a spoof conspiracy theory, have you ever heard of the birds aren't real conspiracy theory? It's this goofy, completely silly conspiracy that all the birds have been replaced by drones that are spying on us. And everybody knows it's silly, but by playing with it and learning how to make a conspiracy theory work, you can activate the conspiracy theory detection systems in a kid's mind. So you get kids together and you have them design their own conspiracy theories, and then they present them to great fanfare at the end of the week, and they try to buffalo one another with goofy rationalizations. And they discover that you can take pretty much any outrageous idea and rationalize it until the cows come home. And conspiracy theories have lots of features that make them particularly handy for that kind of doublethink. And by playing with these innocuous conspiracy theories, kids learn how to spot the really dangerous ones. So exposure to problematic information is part of what we need to be doing in classrooms.
Well, a couple of things that you're talking about. One is the birds aren't real conspiracy theory was a joke, and yet there are plenty of people out there who believed it, as outrageous as it seems. Oh, yes.
Really?
Actually, I heard a story about the guy who created that birds aren't real, and he was very surprised at the number of people that actually did believe it and signed on to it. He did a TED talk or something on it. So that's a little frightening, because you're thinking that you're putting forth this thing that's just a joke, that's trying to teach someone about the anatomy of a conspiracy theory, and then people buy into it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, it's interesting that you talk about vaccine and inoculate, because so many of the people out there, just using that word vaccine is going to turn them off because they believe that vaccines are bad. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's another hard one. I actually try to downplay the idea of a mind vaccine, because I think that arouses fear, unproductive fears. What I try to say instead is, hey, look, we're all challenged by manipulative and false information these days. It's harder to separate the good stuff from the bad stuff. We all need help. We're all susceptible to problematic information. So let's just help each other strengthen our ability to spot and shed this stuff. Right? That doesn't sound anywhere near as, doesn't invoke fear of needles, among other things, right? So there are ways, even though it's helpful for scientists to think of some of these learning strategies as similar to vaccines, there's no reason why the general public has to think of them as mind vaccines. Just think of them as susceptibility mitigation strategies that we can do together by learning better how to take control of our own minds. Because if we don't, other people will take control of them.
Exactly. So a couple of the first questions that we should ask ourselves, you've already mentioned, like, does this incite violence? Does this create division, more division? What are some of the other questions? Because I know one of the strategies is to villainize like a certain person. Yes. Out there. And then I don't know what that model is, like why these people are villainized to then create some bigger story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's become big business to peddle conspiracy theories with villains at their core. Lynn, you mentioned before that some people were actually taken in by the birds aren't real conspiracy theory. I have an idea as to why, that the people who came up with the birds aren't real, and it's kind of a satirical conspiracy theory, right? Part of their shtick is to remain in character as people who are fully believing that all birds are now drones. So they stay in character a lot of the time and don't break out of that character to say, of course, this is all just a ruse. But when you're in the classroom and you have kids play with the spoof conspiracy theories, you tend to debrief at the end by saying, all right, guys, we all know that these were false. Here's how we know these things are false. Now let's talk about it. Why is it that these ideas are so appealing? Why is it that these ideas spread so readily from one person to another? So the debrief actually helps to make sure that people aren't taken in by the spoof conspiracies.
Well, as we come to the end of our time here, I mean, can you give our listeners a few little things that they can work on to strengthen their mental immune systems?
Thank you. I'm glad you asked. Yeah, here's some of my favorites. I think I mentioned one before. Listen to your doubts. Your doubts are your mind's immune system trying to warn you that certain information might not be reliable. It's really important not to develop the habit of squashing or tamping down those doubts and shunting them aside. Listen to them and try to give them expression in the form of questions. When other people raise doubts about your beliefs and claims, try not to overreact and react defensively. Instead, try to welcome those challenges as opportunities to learn, or more specifically, to unlearn things we probably shouldn't have learned in the first place. I think it's important to try to demilitarize the information space. So when issues become political and we start using reasons to attack and one another and defend ourselves, thinking goes downhill fast. Scientists know this, and we cognitive scientists have established this. To think clearly, you have to feel somewhat safe. You actually have to be part of an information environment where you feel like the person representing the opposite point of view is a collaborator who's willing to yield to your good reasons, provided you yield to theirs. That there's this fundamental pact that goes into any good dialogue, which is that if you come up with the better reasons, I'll back down. But if I come up with the better reasons, then, you know, really you should back down. We've got too many culture warriors out now who essentially flout that fundamental norm, and it's destroying our ability to talk through our differences constructively and peacefully, and turning our entire culture into a war zone. Nobody wants to live their life in a minefield of information hazards. So let's calm our own minds. If somebody's giving you information that inflames your passions, especially your anger and your hate and your resentment, stop and think, wait a minute, are they manipulating my emotions? Because chances are pretty good they are. And the way to take back control of our lives is to notice when our emotions are being inflamed by outside actors and say, I don't have to give you the power to do that. I'm going to calm myself down so I can think clearly and calmly about this, because you just can't think properly if your mind is not calm.
That is such a great note to end on. Andy Norman is a cognitive scientist who founded the Mental Immunity Project, and he's the author of the book Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Jay, and thank you, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.